Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. We've traveled to New York City to take part in Climate Week conversations. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
In this episode, we're joined by a special guest here at Climate Week in New York. Dr. Gernot Wagner is a leading climate economist at the Columbia Business School. Dr. Wagner's work focuses on climate risks and policy and is the author of several influential books, including Geoengineering, The Gamble. He previously taught at NYU and Harvard. He was also the founding executive director of Harvard's Solar Geoengineering Research Program. Dr. Wagner, thanks so much for being with us in New York, Climate Week, Path to Zero. Looking forward to a great conversation.
Great to be here.
I know you've already had a busy morning. It's early, and I think you said we're your third meeting. But let's start by talking about kind of your focus of teaching and what you do at Columbia Business School.
Well, I'm the policy guy at a business school, the climate policy person, I guess, right, could mean it's essentially this sort of one class that, you know, may or may not be of interest to a couple of people at some point. What's pretty fascinating to me is how fast things have changed very recently. So I've only been there for 2 years. One of the classes I teach reaches 600 of the 800 MBAs we teach a year. And not because it's required, but because there's just this real interest, not just because it's the right thing to do, but, well, that's how things are going.
In all types of policy, federal policy, international policy, local policy?
Oh, absolutely, and of course, well beyond that, right? So, you know, this is not a policy school, right? So this is not about, okay, we need policy and that's it, get out of the way and everything will be fine. No, of course, it's about getting to, you know, speed and scale and do this fast. Much, much faster than we are currently approaching things. Of course, right, policy is one of the main drivers, not the only one.
I'm aware of at least two books you've written. How many books have you written?
Five, I think.
Five, okay. Yeah. We're going to talk about a couple today. One, Climate Shock, The Economic Consequences of a Hotter Planet, published in 2015. If you look today, 2024, back since you published that book, how much progress have we made?
I remember a first conversation with our editor who basically told us, climate shock, that's a bit catastrophizing. You may not want to push it quite as hard. Turns out I still have my Google News alert, right, every time climate shock appears somewhere in a headline. Turns out that shock is real. Turns out that, you know, 10 years later, science has advanced. We can link many, many more events to fossil fuels. The shock, the not knowing, the risks, the uncertainties, the stuff we fairly recently couldn't quite imagine are in fact hitting home as we speak. So maybe, you know, that's the depressing bit, but that is certainly one real aspect here that is important.
Yeah, interesting. Technology's come so far, but maybe carbon reduction hasn't come quite as far years.
And frankly, everything is speeding up, which is good, right? Boring old solar PV, right? Wasn't all that boring 10 years ago, right? It was sort of the green hydrogen from 10 years ago, or the fusion from 40 years ago. Now is the cheapest source of electricity in history. We are deploying it left and right. It'll dominate sooner rather than later, our not just electricity, but energy system overall. And still, right, it's debatable whether things are getting worse at a higher rate as we speak, even compared to the rapidly increasing, accelerating pace of us deploying just boring old solar panels.
Yes. All right, I think you may be the second guest we've ever had that talks about geoengineering. You founded Harvard's Solar Geoengineering Research Program, which is quite an accomplishment.
Co-founded, but yes.
Talk to the listeners about what solar geoengineering is, maybe why it's a potential tool as we talk about stabilizing the climate.
So first of all, I'm very happy to hear that I'm only the second guest who's talked about this, because frankly, I'd rather not. because it's the sort of topic that, yes, I do think it's not a question of if, but when we will be looking to even something as radical sounding as solar geoengineering. But what it can't be, right, is the sort of distraction where you say, oh, we don't need to do the hard stuff, right? You can have your hamburger in your SUV and we will all be fine, and no, giving up that one hamburger or that one SUV, right, isn't going to solve climate change. Right. And now we're with the reason why we're looking at solar geoengineering research in the first place. So what is it? I guess the easiest way of putting it, it's the same principle as why we wore white between Memorial and Labor Day and why winter jackets are black. Right? White, brighter colors reflect, cool mm-hmm. what is underneath, dark attracts heat, reflects less, and warms. So brightening the planet, literally, right? And if that doesn't sound frightening, then I should try again explaining what it is. But brightening the planet on a planetary scale, yeah, is technically in the cards because volcanoes have been doing it forever, right? So when Mount Pinatubo erupts in the Philippines in 1991, by 92, ironically, right at the time of the first Rio Earth Summit, when 100 plus heads of state go to Rio, global average temperatures in 1992 were about half a degree centigrade, about a degree Fahrenheit, cooler than they would have been without that volcanic eruption.
All the particulate matter.
Tiny little reflective particles in the stratosphere. By the way, we emit plenty of this gunk, right? We kill 8 to 10 million people a year through outdoor air pollution this year. Those tiny particles cool the planet. Doing that potentially, deliberately, in the stratosphere is one of the many potential methods that I would argue are worth looking into, worth researching, largely because even if you don't like it, it's so cheap to do that it may only be a matter of time before somebody somewhere would want to pull the trigger.
Now, the book that we're focusing on today, which I guess is your most recent book, right?
It is. I thought it was Path to Zero. Zero.
But that okay. book, Geoengineering, the subtitle is The Gamble, I think highlights very much the concerns. Yeah. What is the gamble?
The gamble is the uncertainty. Frankly, the gamble is the risks and the uncertainties if we don't act, cutting emissions to zero, mm-hmm. hence the path to zero. And that is clearly the most important bit. The second part, of course, is precisely it's the risks and uncertainties of the potential intervention that geoengineering might pose. And in many ways, it's precisely this risk-risk trade-off that's one of the core features of solar geoengineering.
And we often talk about the science is settled or the science isn't settled. This is clearly an area where scientists don't agree, right? Some, you even see it almost as a last-ditch effort. But certainly some scientists would say you're letting the genie out of the bottle and that could lead to horrific negative consequences. True?
That's true. Now, I would say, frankly, those who are closest to the research, right, the natural scientists who are closest to the research, I think would all come to similar conclusions that says, look, I don't like it. I don't want to talk about it. But it is so late in the game that, yes, as a scientist, maybe my biggest contribution here is looking into the risks, the uncertainties, and yes, the potential net benefits of this potential intervention without detracting from the need to actually cut emissions.
And solar geoengineering is really much bigger than one trick pony of just particulate matter into the clouds, right? It's other tools available for solar geoengineering?
Well, not yet available, just to be clear, but yeah. Yes, right? So maybe the sort of most interesting one, if you will, is this is Lagrange point between the sun and the earth, right? If you put something there, it doesn't move. High school physics, it stays stable there. So what if we were to be able to put some sort of sail there, space-based solar geoengineering that, basically dims the sun ever so slightly, right? We're not talking about turning down the sun, 50% or something. It's, a fraction of a percent. Nobody would notice. But we could potentially lower global average temperatures that way. And again, right? So I don't want to create the impression that this is the solution. It's not. It's, if anything, it's sort of, it's the painkiller. Right? It's the sort of thing that would have been nice to have dieted and exercised all your life. And now you walk into the doctor's office with the back pain and overweight and so on. And thank God those painkillers do exist, because frankly, that's the only way to now go to the gym and exercise. And that's solar geoengineering, right? It's not addressing the root cause of the problem.
In prepping for you a little bit, I heard you talk about green moral hazards, in which you kind of talk about just talking about technologies like nuclear or geoengineering actually detract from the real issue, which is cutting emissions. How big a problem?
So, frankly, moral hazards are all around, mm-hmm. right? So, this is sort of, not to get too political immediately, but when we debated healthcare in this country under Obamacare, right, there were some fairly prominent voices that said, if you provide health insurance to those who currently don't have it, they will just let themselves go. And, the rest of us will pay for when some accident strikes. That's moral hazard, right? Seatbelts engender moral hazard. IUDs and condoms, moral hazard. Right? So the political right basically says, look, I don't want teenagers to do that thing we don't want them to do. And there's this technofix called condoms and IUDs that allows them to do more of it without facing the consequences. Well, that's sort of the, political rights argument. On the left, in many ways, it's the green moral hazards, where there's frankly this long history in this country. Actually, it was the first time I teamed up with a historian to write sort of a 12,000 word historical essay. First and last time, I believe, I'm doing this. So what we unearthed essentially was that moral hazards, the thinking around moral hazards in many ways is at the core of not just the US, but sort of the global environmental movement writ large, right? It's always been sort of this, there's this technofix. Well, yes, good up to a point, right? Like seatbelts. Yes, they save lives. But now moral hazard means we do more of the behavior, like driving fast, like using lots of energy, that we otherwise wouldn't do if that technology weren't available. Right. None of that means that the technology itself isn't good, but there might be some reasons to want to channel that technology in a better direction than just letting things go on its own.
Yeah, Will said, technology is but one part of the system, for sure. Human factors, which very few people I find outside of Columbia even think about how technology is foisted on individuals and how they receive it and use it. So,
we started this talking about policy, right? And frankly, it's policy, it's technology, it's behavioral change, it's all these things. It's business models, it's finance, of course, and it's the right mix of these. It's always technology. Solar panels are technology, right? Not too long ago, solar panels was this, it's about, it's more expensive than the fossil alternative. Wouldn't it be nice if we could do that? Well, now we can. And guess what? Some of those who want to distract from the need to cut emissions now are now dangling other technologies in front of us, right? Yeah, that means moral hazard, right?
I want to talk about a piece you wrote in the New York Times, op-ed piece, "Don't Slam the Door on Inexpensive Chinese Electric Vehicles." You really talk about, and correctly so, one of the few voices I heard on this, maybe the fallacies of taxing inexpensive Chinese EV. Talk about why you see that tariff, and more so even why you would want to have these inexpensive Chinese vehicles come into North America. Or Europe, for that matter, right? Both places are...
Yes. So to be clear, there are trade-offs. Let's start with that, right? And the green industrial policy of the Inflation Reduction Act in this country, for example, is good, is very good. Is doing some of the right things that, frankly, we should have done a long time ago when, yes, in many ways, the Chinese were first, subsidized the domestic solar panel industry, battery industry, batteries as a main ingredient of component of electric vehicles, and we are behind. We truly are behind. There is probably a case to be made for temporary, small tariffs like that, except probably not the flat EV tariff, but for example, something like a carbon border adjustment, what mm-hmm. the EU actually is also doing, that is truly focused on what we ought to care about, the CO2 footprint, right? Now, the problem comes in when we basically try to protect domestic manufacturing and in many ways the domestic car industry without in some sense asking them to change their ways at all, right? We let them stamp out the SUVs and, you know, kill our kids and cyclists left and right, while at the same time protecting them with these EV tariffs. Cheap EVs, cheap solar panels and so on are good. We need more of them.
Right.
But yes, we need to figure out how to cut through these trade-offs and make sure that by, for example, having a tariff on carbon content of imported goods, channel things in the right direction while we avoid the sort of flat out, right, whatever Trump's proposal is, 200% or whatever tariffs, right, that yes, is a tax on U.S. consumers.
Do you think, though, and so again, I love your perspective, business school policy. Do you think, though, that if governments, particularly Europe and North America, don't act now, that the Chinese technology will be so far ahead that American industry, European industry will never catch it?
Up to a point, yes. And frankly, that is a real struggle, right? The real struggle is, actually, you know, solar panels may be a good example. So Germany actually came first.
Right.
Germany, like, yeah, starting 2005 or so, right, started subsidizing both not just learning by doing externalities, as in deployment of panels, which, yes, we should all do, too, feed-in tariffs and so on, but actually started subsidizing a domestic solar industry. They pulled back, and the Chinese stepped in. And, of course, well, 90-plus percent of modules and so on, 97% of wafers, solar wafers, main ingredient into the panels, is manufactured in China. That's good up to a point. Cheap panels are good, right? The fact that the price is so low is good. There are, of course, some real trade-offs. And yes, right, European competitiveness, U.S. competitiveness, and so on suffers because we didn't jump on the green industrial policy bandwagon fast enough.
Right. So you've talked a couple times about carbon tariffs. It's kind of this one tool you clearly see as the right way to begin to manage carbon, right?
Well, a small, right? A small one, right? That only addresses trade. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to be clear, right? So yes,
just as it relates to trade.
I have a PhD in economics, political economy, technically. So I'm obligated to say that the first best solution in many ways would have been, choosing those words carefully, would have been taxing, pricing the negative carbon externality much, much earlier, right? I mean, that's it, right? Polluter pays, right? Everyone pays for the $200+ per ton of CO2 that we cause in costs every time we emit one of these tons. The way to address this isn't just the carbon border tariff. That's a trade policy. But to actually tax, price carbon, right? Europe does that. California does it, emissions trading system, right? 85% of California's emissions, right? So my fellow Austro-American who, you know, came over with slightly more steroids in his suitcase, when he signed this law into place, Schwarzenegger, in California, yes, that makes a real difference. There's a carbon price, right? $30+ per ton of CO2.
Right.
Not high enough, not ambitious enough. But of course, the step from 0 to 30 is a lot harder than from 30 to 100, 200.
I think everybody that we come into contact with feels clearly carbon pricing, carbon tariffs are the right tool.
is one tool. Yes.
You are an economist.
Yes.
Economists could probably set a fair price for carbon. Do you agree?
Not sure I would trust them to do that.
Who would you? So we clearly would agree that politicians should not set that price.
Well, of course, it's policy.
Who sets the price?
Well, government does.
Can we trust? Do you think we can trust government to set the right price, a fair price?
I mean, given all the fossil lobbying, I wouldn't necessarily. Yeah. I mean, of course, right? So the European Union Emissions Trading System, which is a market-based solution to climate change, is a government creation, of course, right? It takes policy, it takes coordination on a large scale to make sure that all of us internalize that negative cost and also internalize the positive cost, right? That's where the subsidies come in. So, you know, this is sort of, you know, me, oh, wow, I arrived sweaty this morning on my bike and, you know, look at me, I'm vegetarian. Yeah, of course, sure. None of those individual steps add up to enough. It takes policy, of course. And by the way, right, so yes, I teach at a business school and sort of, you know, duh, of course, right? I guess maybe the best way to put this is, it doesn't matter whether it's the head of BlackRock or the head of BCG or McKinsey or, you know, any of these funds. Basically, everyone says, look, we are focused on this transition because we anticipate that we will have more of this negative externality priced in through, by the way, whichever means necessary, right? So economists might say, oh, the best efficient way is the carbon tax, the price, and get out of the way. Every regulation has an indirect price. Right. Every time, you know, when Minnesota passes a climate action framework and essentially says we will decarbonize our electricity sector and spend $1 billion+ on decarbonizing transport and so on, all of that establishes indirectly, if you will, a carbon price, right? And yeah, that's how we should be doing this. Now, there are, you know, better and worse ways of doing this, but at the end, of course, it's politics that sets this price.
Interesting. Let me ask you one last question, then we'll get to some of the fun questions. But
wait, this wasn't fun?
It's great fun and really educational. You talk a lot about policy. Well, and I appreciate that you're in the U.S., but you clearly have a European viewpoint as well. And we see governments to a degree acting differently. What's more important, policy, innovation, or policy that's backed up by significant investment?
It's all of the above, of course. Right? Okay, so, okay, U.S., Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. So, okay, a couple of points. So, first of all, horribly named as a re-election strategy, right? That Inflation Reduction Act does not decrease inflation by November 5th, 2024. And we knew that when it was signed on August 18th, 2022. Maybe slightly, right? This is what Isabel Schnabel, a German member of the European Central Bank's executive committee, would call greenflation. Mm-hmm. Yes. It is beautifully named when it comes to the long-term goal of addressing what, again, Isabel Schnabel called fossilflation, and for that matter, climateflation, right? It's these three things, right? Climateflation, extreme climate events, emergency, prices go up, inflation. Right? And the more unmitigated climate change we experience, the more impact on inflation. And yes, we can measure that, and it's significant. Fossilflation is, you know, every time Putin blows a fuse, February 24th, 22, right, invades another country, gas prices spike 10x in Europe, for example, and by the way, around the world. Right, inflation in August 2022, more than half of it was driven by the spike in fossil fuel prices, including here in the US, right? Not just in Europe, of course. And yes, the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, tries to get us off fossil fuels in general, which is the only way to address this fossilflation, right? So, you know, this is, I'm old enough to remember it every 8-10 years, right? Some geopolitical event and fossil prices spike yet again. And every time again, right, lots of hand-wringing, lots of, oh, what should we do? More troops in the Mideast. How do we do this? Yeah, we should get our fossil fuels, pump more domestically, right? All these sort of political conversations. And, you know, 6 months later, we start buying SUVs again because, well, look, that was long ago. The only real fix, long-term fix, is to get our fossil fuels. And yes, that's, of course, the IRA's play. Now, to your question, right, public versus private. Actually, first estimate of the cost of the IRA, $369 billion, Congressional Budget Office.
A bit low.
Right? That was low, yes. Well, fast forward 18 months, Goldman Sachs research says $1.2 trillion in public money, which, you know, cue the Wall Street Journal editorial board saying, oh my God, right, CBO, of course, and the Democrats lied to us. Well, no, not at all, right? They're open-ended tax credits here.
Right.
That, you know, the Exxons of the world love to cash in on, of course. And we should let them, of course. Right. And by the way, the $1.2 trillion in public investment, over $3 trillion over 10 years, over 12, I believe, trillion dollars through 2050, just through the IRA alone in private investments. Because, of course, the, you know, the nature of a tax credit is that, yes, you get, you know, quite a bit of money back, right? But you're not getting 100% back. You have to put up at least twice as much money yourself as a private investor, private company, than the feds are ultimately going to give you.
We really appreciate your time. Love your expertise. Looking forward to, you know, talking about your book a bit more. We want to plant a tree in your name and your honor in a national forest in the U.S., preferably. Is there a place that you would like to see a tree planted in your honor?
I don't think it's a national forest, but is, you know, Exxon headquarters the main drive in still for grass? So thank you. Now, this goes to a couple deeper questions, just to be clear, right? So yes, trees are good. We need more of them, of course, right? If trees are the thing we do to get to net zero, and of course I appreciate how this podcast is called Path to Zero, not Path to Net Zero, right? If the net is doing a lot of work, right? If planting the tree gets me out of doing the hard stuff, then, you know, please don't, right? If it is yes and, yeah, of course. Right? And, you know, ideally, you know, maybe not in the U.S., so, you know, maybe in Arizona, sort of arid U.S., right? Where hopefully this tree will survive. But more importantly, of course, you know, this is my day job, right? Sector by sector, when you look at how to actually cut emissions, by and large, there are dozens of technologies, including planting trees, including offsets, that will cut emissions 5%.
Right?
And, you know, it's like electrify the executive jacuzzi, right? Like that sort of stuff, or the bike to work day and whatever else, right? Whatever the SVP for sustainability can do, you know, is in her purview, right? But there are two, three technologies, by and large, that actually cut emissions 90, 95, 100%, right? And, you know, maybe an example sort of close to home. You know, how do you cut emissions from the building sector? From your home, right? You know, your 40-year-old gas furnace poops out on the coldest day of the year, of course, right? That's when they tend to die. And the contractor shows up and says, look, I have a new gas furnace here, right? I can install this today, and you will feel, you know, we'll be warm tonight, right? And by the way, it's 40% more efficient than the 40-year-old you could have, right? Now, of course, cutting emissions 40% is good. But by installing yet another gas furnace, you've just locked yourself into burning gas for another 40 years, right? What are the two technologies that actually cut emissions? Well, okay, insulate, of course, and electrify. Won't cut emissions overnight, right? Because the electric grid needs to be decarbonized too, and that's outside your individual purview. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's the only way, right? The, you know, induction stove and especially the heat pump, of course, is the only way to actually cut emissions 100%. And that's the trade-off, right? Yeah, that's a long answer to you planting a tree, right? But basically, if the small individual step, right? You know, planting a tree as sort of the extreme example, maybe, you know, lets one check a box that says, "Yep, did something good." And it detracts from the need to actually implement the solution that, by the way, might increase emissions today, right? The investment necessary to, you know, dig up the geothermal heat pump for the massive apartment building or even the smallish one, right? The contractor coming in mixing new cement will increase emissions this year, right? Won't cut it the 40% more efficient gas furnace will do, but it allows that path to actual zero, as opposed to, right, the sort of, oh, you know, a bit of biofuels here, a bit of efficiency there, slightly more efficient coal blast furnace for the iron steel production. Yeah, cuts emission a bit this year, not going to get us to zero.
So one of the things we do love to talk about, that's a great answer. For us, planting the tree is a way to do two things. One, to thank you, but also to kind of show that people, individuals, can make tangible steps.
Can they?
To get engaged, absolutely. I think that's been the issue here. Is for everyone else, this is this existential issue handled by others. And part of what we're trying to do here day after day is talk to individuals about how they too can make a step.
Of course.
Plant a tree today, ride your bike tomorrow, turn down your thermostat.
I like how you put this, right?
All
because
of those things.
It's precise, right? It's, frankly, right. It's always about what's the next step.
Right. That someone else is going to do, by the way.
Of course.
Is the next step that you can do, that you will do, that will empower you, will engage you, and then move from there.
So, yes.
That's good. So I'm Dr. Gernot Wagner, climate economist, author of four books, you said?
Five. I think there's a sixth one. It's in German, and yeah, that nobody's heard of it, but yes.
Columbia Business School, what a great time to this morning in New York, Climate Week. Thanks for being with us on Path to Zero.
Thanks so much, Tucker.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins from Climate Week in New York City. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.